Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Hello and welcome to the deep dive. Today we are tackling, well, a giant of a novel, Joseph Conrad's Nostromo, a tale of the seaboard.
It really is massive, yeah.
It's this sprawling political epic, and honestly, it can feel like a kind of blueprint for so many global issues, all wrapped up in fiction.
It is absolutely colossal. And the Nostromo, it's often pointed to as like a cornerstone of literary modernism.
Right.
But, you know, for a lot of readers, it feels almost impenetrable. It's complex. It's dense.
Definitely.
So our goal today really is to try and cut through some of that complexity. We wanted to distill the main story threads and, importantly, get at Conrad's really powerful argument about what he called material interests.
Serial interests.
Yeah, this idea that they just relentlessly chip away at, well, our moral integrity, the human spirit even.
Okay, let's get into it. And I think to really understand Nostromo, you kind of have to understand Conrad himself first.
Right? Absolutely essential.
His background is fascinating. He was born in Poland, Joseph Theodor Conrad Gortzenowski, orphaned young, spent maybe 2 decades as a merchant marine.
Sailing all over the world.
Exactly. And crucially, English wasn't his first language. It wasn't even his second. He mastered it as his third language.
Which is just incredible when you read his prose. And that background, being Polish, being a seaman, it gives him this almost uncanny clarity, an outsider's perspective on things like British commerce, the empire, global capitalism.
He sees it differently.
Completely. And Nostromo, which came out in 1904, is really the culmination of that viewpoint. It pulls heavily from his time in and research about South America. It's just this incredibly ambitious critique of, well, foreign intervention and maybe the destructive allure of wealth, an easy money idea.
And the setting for all this critique is the fictional Republic of Costaguana, specifically this isolated province, Sulaco.
Yeah, Sulaco. It's almost walled off from the rest of the country by these huge mountains, the Higuerota Range.
Like a world unto itself.
Pretty much. And its entire existence, its money, its politics, all the instability, the conflict that eventually erupts it, all circles around one thing. The San Tome silver mine.
With silver.
And this silver, it's not just presented as wealth. Conrad really frames it as something more sinister, like a genuinely malevolent force, a curse almost.
A curse. That feels central. Which I guess brings us to the core philosophical question of the novel, maybe the thing for you, the listener, to keep in mind throughout.
Mm-hmm.
Can human ideals, things like justice, loyalty, love, even just good intentions, can they actually survive when they come up against the, I don't know, the sheer gravity of material wealth?
And the first character we really see wrestling with this is the mine's owner, Charles Gould. He's known as the King of Sulaco. Very stoic, very reserved.
Okay.
And his goal, at least at first, seems genuinely idealistic.
Yeah.
He sort of believes that economic development, driven by his mine, will finally bring order and stability to Costaguana, which is always in chaos.
But wait. He's a foreign owner, right? An Englishman in Costaguana. Can that ideal even work? Doesn't that foreign intervention kind of taint the ideal from the start, no matter how good his intentions seem?
Well, that's the classic Conradian dilemma, isn't it?
Yeah.
Gould is driven partly by this need to restore his family's honor. They'd faced ruin in Costaguana before. He genuinely thinks the mine can be a force for good.
Okay.
But that belief slowly, surely twists into this chilling, single-minded obsession. The mine becomes everything. He does succeed in building this separate state, the Occidental Republic, but he loses himself in the process, and his wife, Amelia.
Amelia Gould. She feels like the moral heart of the story, doesn't she?
She starts out supportive of Charles, but her journey is just one of deep, painful disillusionment. She becomes incredibly lonely.
Because she sees what the silver is doing.
Exactly. She's maybe the only one who truly sees the silver for what it is, this curse that hollows people out spiritually, even the ones who think they're doing the right thing.
That's tragic. Her isolation.
It's profound. Because she's surrounded by people driven by reputation, by material goals. She just has to watch all this idealism crumble, and she's left as this compassionate but ultimately powerless observer.
Which leads us perfectly to the man whose whole identity is built on reputation, Nostromo himself, the title character.
Giovanni Battista Fidanza. He's Italian, the head longshoreman, the capataz de cargadores. Everyone admires him.
Our man.
That's it. He's maybe the most complex, tragic figure in the book because his whole sense of self-worth is tied up in what other people think of him. He's incredibly proud of his competence, almost vain about his reputation for being incorruptible, brave.
That reliance on external validation, it feels so precarious. If your worth is all based on what others say, what happens when they don't appreciate you enough or perceive you wrongly?
It's terrifyingly fragile.
Yeah.
And then there's Martin Decoux. We should mention him. He's this intellectual, very Parisian, a journalist.
The cynic.
Very much the cynic. Deeply skeptical about everything. He only gets involved in the whole mess because he's desperately in love with Antonia Avellanos, who's very patriotic. Decoux sort of represents the detached intellectual forced into action, forced into compromise.
Okay, so we've got this unstable nation, this immense cursed wealth, and these characters all teetering between idealism and vanity, or cynicism. It feels like a powder keg.
It absolutely is, and the explosion comes.
Tell us about the coup, the big turning point.
Well, the sort of fragile peace in Sulaco just gets shattered.
Mm.
There's a military coup led by these populist figures, the Montero brothers.
And the mine.
Immediately becomes the number one target, all that silver.
Yeah.
And revolutionaries need it.
So Charles Gould has to act to save his mine, his vision.
He makes a desperate decision. He needs to get a huge shipment of silver ingots out of Sulaco, away from the Monteros.
Mm-hmm.
And he entrusts this incredibly dangerous mission to Nostromo and also to Decoux.
Smuggling silver out on a lighter, a small barge, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Under the cover of darkness. And this journey, this is the real point of no return. They're sailing in the pitch black, out on the Gulf of Placido, the Placid Gulf, which is deeply ironic.
Because it's anything but placid.
Right. And their little lighter gets struck by a transport ship. It's carrying soldiers for one of the revolutionary leaders, Sotillo.
Disaster.
Chaos. The silver gets scattered, but they manage to salvage a huge amount of it and hide the treasure on this deserted island, Great Isabel.
And this is where Nostromo's path really changes.
Fundamentally. He swims ashore, leaving Decoud on the island, and tells everyone the silver was lost at sea.
He lies.
He lies. Then he does something incredibly brave. He makes this epic ride over the mountains to fetch General Barrios and his loyalist army.
The ride that saves Sulaco.
It secures the independence of this new state, the Occidental Republic. Nostromo becomes a national hero, savior of Sulaco.
But inside?
Inside, something's broken. He feels like his huge sacrifice, this heroic act, wasn't properly appreciated by the rich Europeans, by Gould. That feeling of being slighted, combined with the secret, the knowledge that he knows where this immense treasure is, it starts to rot his integrity.
The hero becomes something else.
He starts down the path to becoming a thief, driven by resentment and that secret knowledge.
And Decoud, what happens to him back on the island?
Decoud's fate is, well, it's maybe even bleaker. He's left alone on Great Isabel, guarding the silver. And his intellectual detachment, his cynicism, it offers him absolutely no defense against what Conrad calls absolute solitude.
He can't cope with being utterly alone.
His sense of self, which really depended on having a society to observe and critique, it just dissolves. He unravels completely.
Mm.
He's found dead later. He killed himself, weighed his pockets down with ingots of the silver he was supposed to protect, and walked into the sea, literally drowned by the material interests he was caught up in.
That's devastating. Not just a metaphor, literal drowning in silver. You know, there's that quote from the source material that seems so relevant here. Action is consolatory. It is the enemy of thought and the friend of flattering illusions.
That hits it exactly. Gould and Nostromo are men of action, aren't they? Gould runs the mine. Nostromo performs these heroic deeds. They use constant activity, maybe, to avoid thinking too hard about the moral compromises they're making.
Yeah.
And the great, terrible irony for Nostromo is that the very moment he becomes this national hero, the savior, is the exact moment his own moral decay begins.
Mm.
He saves the Republic but loses his soul.
So we jump forward then. Several years later, part three of the novel, The Lighthouse. What's the situation?
Well, on the surface, the Occidental Republic, Sulaco, is stable. It's even seen as a success story, you know, built on that foreign investment. But it's all a bit hollow, a facade.
And Gould.
Charles Gould is emotionally dead. He's completely enslaved to the mine now. It defines him. His marriage to Amelia is cold, distant, and the ultimate irony. They build a lighthouse on Great Isabel.
The island with the secret treasure.
The very same place, shining this literal light on the darkness of their compromises. It's potent symbolism.
And Nostromo, what's become of him?
He's totally consumed by his secret. He's now secretly digging up the silver ingots one by one under the cover of darkness. He's become a slave to the very wealth he once might have despised.
How does he manage that with the lighthouse there?
He uses the lighthouse keeper's family as cover. Old Giorgio Viola, a figure from the past, an idealist, is the keeper. Nostromo gets engaged to Viola's elder daughter, Linda.
But
he gets entangled with her younger sister, Giselle. The need to protect his secret hoard of silver leads him into this web of personal deception, too.
It just corrupts everything it touches.
Everything. He's lost that public admiration he craved and replaced it with the secret power of wealth, and it's destroying him from the inside out.
Which brings us to the climax, the final awful irony.
Yeah. One night, Nostromo goes to Great Isabel to retrieve more silver, and old Giorgio Viola, the lighthouse keeper.
Linda and Giselle's father.
He sees a figure moving in the dark near where Giselle is. He thinks it's some unwanted suitor trying to steal her away. He shoots.
And hits Nostromo.
Hits Nostromo. The great hero dies, not in battle, but shot in the dark like a common thief by this old, disillusioned revolutionary idealist who mistakes him for someone else entirely.
Just devastatingly bleak.
He dies lonely. Pathetic. They bring him to Mrs. Gould in his last moments. She's the only one he feels he can trust. He tries to tell her the secret, where the rest of the silver is hidden.
But he can't.
He dies before he can get the words out. The silver remains lost, hidden, still out there, a permanent, untouchable curse hanging over Sulaco forever.
Wow. Okay, let's try and pull back and connect these threads. What are the big takeaways? Why does this story still hit so hard?
Well, first, you see the total failure of idealism, right? Gould's idea of benevolent capitalism creating order. Crushed. Old Viola's pure revolutionary ideals. Also crushed. They both get steamrolled by the, I guess, the cynical mechanics of power and greed.
The means destroy the ends.
Pretty much. The actions required to achieve the ideal inevitably corrupt the ideal itself.
And the critique of imperialism, or maybe neo-imperialism, is unavoidable. Sulaco isn't officially a colony, but it's completely dependent on foreign money, embodied by that American financier, Holroyd.
Right. And it makes you ask, reading it today, are things really that different?
Mm-hmm.
Are nations still beholden to global economic forces, often disguised as progress, but leading to exploitation and dependency? Feels very modern.
Then there's the theme of illusion versus reality, especially with Nostromo. His entire identity was based on what people thought of him.
Exactly. When he felt slighted, when that external validation wasn't enough, his inner moral compass just vanished. Conrad has this line about needing the sanction of his own conscience. Nostromo finds out too late that he doesn't really have one, only a need for applause.
And we have to touch on the style, too. That nonlinear structure Conrad uses, the famous Conradian time shift. It's confusing at first, but why do you think he does that? How does it add to the feeling of doom?
It's a key modernist technique. By breaking up the timeline, showing us consequences before causes, it creates this feeling of inevitability. Like we're looking back at history, already knowing the tragic outcome.
So you piece it together like fragments.
Yeah, and that fragmentation reinforces the sense that the past is always pressing down on the present, that the curse of the silver was always going to win, no matter what the characters tried to do. It feels fated.
So reflecting on it all, Nostromo seems to be this stark reminder that chasing material success, even if you start with noble goals, can, maybe will, erode the spirit, both for individuals and for whole societies.
Yeah, it forces you to question what progress really means if it's built on these hidden moral compromises. The silver is still buried at the end, still a curse. Are we just building our own modern lighthouses over similar buried secrets?
A deeply unsettling thought to end on. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.